you read in the newspaper. People write all kinds of things.
Oh, I believe this one, honey. I know those men. What they do, no one's gonna make me think this is impossible.
There is no way it can be true. Mr. Edwards would never use bailout money for his own things. And even if the other man at Barclays used this prostitute, how does she know which pocket the money came out of? Mr. Edwards has his own money. He would never touch government money.
Maybe not, but what about touching prostitutes? You think he's never used one, or two, or 100? I bet you've seen him.
I've never seen anything.
Poor Cindy.
Poor her for what?
For when she reads this, she's gonna go crazy.
She is not going to believe any of this, Jende said, getting upset, and wondering if Leah was excited about the downfall of a family or just loving the gossip. It is funny in this country how people write lies about other people. It is not right. In my country, we gossip a lot, but no one would ever write it down the way they do in America.
Oh, Jende, Leah said, laughing. You really believe in Clark, huh?
I don't like it when people make up stories about other people, Jende said, getting increasingly agitated at Leah's glee. And how does this woman even know what Mr. Edwards' title is?
Yeah, that's the one thing that's funny, right? The madams don't give the name of the clients to the girls. The girls are just told the time and place to show up. And please, honey, don't ask me how I know all this.
Leah laughed at herself. Jende did not join her.
But Cindy,
Leah went on,
she's not going to care about any of that. That woman is paranoid to a T. And let me warn you, she's going to be asking you lots of questions. She used to pepper me with questions whenever she had a chance, and I had to tell her, woman, I don't work for you. You can't take 20 minutes of my time.
What is she going to ask me?
Oh, tons of stuff, honey,
Leah said, and Jende could sense her smiling, perhaps delighting herself with the thought of the entertaining drama that was likely to unfold.
She's gonna ask you if you ever took him to a hotel, if you ever saw one of those bimbos. I'd be really careful if I were you, because...
Leah, please, stop worrying yourself for me, Jende said, forcing himself to sound nonchalant. If she has any questions, she'll ask her husband.
The poor woman. I'd hate to be in her shoes, any of their shoes. Now you see why I never bothered getting married?
Actually, Jende thought, you didn't get married because no one wanted to marry you, or you didn't find anyone you loved enough to marry, because no woman with a brain intact will say no to a man she loves if the man wants to marry her. Women enjoy making noise about independence, but every woman, American or not, appreciates a good man. If that wasn't the case, why did so many movies end with a woman smiling because she finally got a man?
I mean, marriage is good, don't get me wrong, Leah went on,
as Jende barely listened because he was praying the story was fake and Cindy would be able to tell that someone was out to hurt men like Clark.
They've been through a lot, you know. Clark almost died one time. Ruptured his appendix so bad it burst. He had to be rushed into emergency surgery. And I think, if I remember clearly, that was the year Mighty was born a preemie. Apparently, Cindy only wanted one child, and they didn't plan for Mighty. At least that's what I heard. Though I bet Cindy is thanking her lucky stars she had a second child. Now that Vince has run off to India, and Mighty's the only one left. Anyway, the poor thing spent a whole month in the hospital. Clark and Cindy, God bless them, they pulled through together. But that's marriage, right? He tells me to send her calls to voicemail. But when you see them at company parties, you'd think they're the happiest couple in...
I'm sorry, Leah, Jende said, looking at the clock and starting the car.
Some people are real good at covering up their shit. And these people, if you weren't in my position, you wouldn't know a thing, judging from how they're laughing and...
I'm sorry, Leah, Jende said again. I really have to go get Mighty.
Oh, sorry, honey,
Leah chimed.
Go on. But promise you're gonna call me and tell me what happens when Cindy finds out. I'm dying to know.
Jende dismissively promised to do so, and quickly hung up, remembering only minutes later that he hadn't asked her how her job search was going. The last time they'd spoken, Leah had sounded depressed about not getting any calls back after sending out over 50 resumes. But today she'd sounded cheerful, thanks to sordid details about the lives of others. Women and gossip. But what if Leah wasn't just making up gossip to pass the time? He called Winston as he drove uptown, hoping to ask him to read the story online and advise him on what he needed to do. But Winston didn't pick up. He thought about calling Nenny, but decided it would be useless. What would she say besides something along the lines of what Leah had said? He needed to decide what he was going to say to Cindy when he picked her up at 5. He had to assume she'd read the story. He had to imagine that she would have questions for him as they drove to Lincoln Center, where she was to meet a friend for dinner and the opera. He had to be prepared to assure her again and again that he had never seen Clark with a prostitute, and that was the truth. He had never seen Mr. Edwards with a prostitute with his own eyes. He had to be ready for Cindy to doubt him, but he had to try as hard as he could to convince her that he knew nothing about it, and everything he'd written in the blue notebook was the absolute truth.
"Good evening, madame," he said, as he held the car door open for her.
She did not reply. Her countenance was as hard as marble, her eyes covered with sunglasses in the light darkness. Her lips pursed so tightly it was unimaginable they had ever broken into a smile.
"Lincoln Center, madame. Take me home."
"Yes, madame." He waited for her questions, but nothing came. Not one word during the 40-minute traffic-laden ride to the Sapphire. Not even a word on her phone. He imagined she had turned her phone off, and he couldn't blame her for silencing the world at such a time. Her friends were probably trying to reach her to express their shock, tell her how awfully sorry they were, say all manner of things that would do nothing to take away her disgrace. What good would it do her to listen to all that? And if they weren't calling her, they were calling each other to say, "Can you believe it? Clark, of all people. Poor Cindy must be utterly devastated." But how could he? "Do you think the story is true? What's she gonna do now?" And they would go on and on, saying the same kind of things his mother's friends used to say in their kitchen in Limbe, when one of their mate's husbands had been caught atop a spread-eagled woman. In Newtown, in New York, the women all seemed to agree that the friend had to find a way to move on, forgetting that the wreckage of so devastating a betrayal cannot easily be cleared away. As they approached the Sapphire, Jende looked at Cindy in the rearview mirror, hoping she would say something, anything, to open up the opportunity for him to profess his innocence. But she remained silent. He had not anticipated this silence, and even if he had, he wouldn't have imagined it would be more dread-inducing than the questions. They got within a block of the Sapphire, and still she remained silent, her face fully drawn down and turned toward the window and the cold, dark world outside.
"I'm taking you to the office at 11:30 tomorrow, madame,"
he asked as he pulled in front of the building. She did not respond.
"I have the book with all the entries for the day, madame," he said,
as he held the car door open for her to exit.
"I wrote down everything he—"
"Keep it," she said as she walked away. "I've got no use for it anymore." Chapter 34. First, he thought it was just a cold. The boy had been sniffling ever since they pulled out from in front of the Sapphire. Then he thought Mighty was making playful sounds to amuse himself, so he asked no questions. Most mornings, Jende would have asked him how he was feeling, if he was all right. But today his mind was on nothing but the quagmire in which he was wobbling, and the adversities that were certain to engulf him if he couldn't extricate himself from the Edwards' marriage and protect his job. He had to talk to Winston as soon as he was alone in the car, get advice on what to say or do, or not say or not do, when he picked up Cindy later in the morning.
"Do you have any tissues?"
Mighty asked him at a traffic light. Jende pulled one out of the glove compartment and turned to give it to him.
Mighty, he said, surprised to see a tear running down the boy's left cheek. What is wrong? What happened?
Nothing,
Mighty whispered, wiping his eyes.
Oh, no, Mighty. Please, tell me. Are you okay?
Mighty nodded. Jende pulled to the side of the street. They needed to be at the school in 10 minutes to avoid being late, but he wasn't going to let a child go to school crying. His father once did that to him, let him cry all the way to school when he was 8, the day after his grandfather died. He had begged his father to let him stay home for that one day, but his father had refused. Sitting at home and not learning how to read and write is not going to bring your Mbamba back, Pa Jonga had said to Jende and his brothers as he left the house with other male relatives to go dig a grave. Jende had begged his mother to let him stay home after his father left, but his mother, never one to disobey her husband, had dried her son's eyes and told him to go to school. Even now, 30 years later, he still remembered the despondency of that day, wiping his eyes with the hem of his uniform as he walked up Church Street with his Mukutu school bag. Friends telling him Ashiaya over and over, which made him cry even more. Floundering in grief as he watched his classmates excitedly raise their hands to answer arithmetic questions and tell the teacher who discovered Cameroon. The Portuguese, sitting under the cashew tree during recess, thinking of his Mbamba while other boys played football. He turned off the car and got into the back seat.
Tell me what is wrong, Mighty, he said. Please.
Mighty closed his eyes to squeeze out his tears.
Did someone say something to you? Is someone bothering you at school?
We're not going anymore,
Mighty said.
We're not going to St. Bart's.
Oh, I am so very sorry to hear that, Mighty. Your mother just told you that? He shook his head.
They didn't tell me. I can tell. I heard everything last night.
You heard what?
Everything. Her screaming. She was crying.
His face was fully red, his nose flaring and unflaring as he struggled to compose himself and handle his heartache with as much dignity as a 10-year-old could.
I stood outside their door. I heard Mom crying and Dad saying that maybe it was time to stop everything, that he couldn't play games anymore. And Mom, she was just crying and screaming so loud.
Jende took the tissue Mighty had in his hand. Married people fight all the time, Mighty, he said as he wiped the tears rolling down Mighty's cheeks. You know that, right?
Just the other night, me and Nenny, we had a fight,
but the next morning we were friends again. You know your mommy and daddy are going to be friends again, right? Mighty shook his head. I will not worry myself too much if I was you. They will become friends again, I promise you. You will go to St. Bart's, and I will hear about all the fun.
It's going to be the worst Christmas ever.
Oh, Mighty, Jende said, pulling the child to his chest. He thought for a moment that someone might see him and call the police. A black man with a white boy against his chest inside a luxury car on the side of a street on the Upper East Side. But he hoped no one would, because he wasn't going to push the child away as his tears ran full force. He was going to let Mighty have a good cry, because sometimes all a person needs to feel better is a really good cry.
Can I come visit you and Nanny this weekend?
Mighty asked, wiping his nose with the back of his hand after he'd finished his cry and Jende had dried his eyes again.
Me and Nenny would be so glad to have you, Mighty.
That is a very good idea, but your parents, we cannot lie to them.
Please, Jende, just for a little bit.
I am sorry, Mighty. I would really like for you to come, but I cannot do something like that.
Not even for 1 hour? Maybe Stacy could come, too.
Jende shook his head. Mighty nodded sadly, wiping the last of the fluids on his face. But you know what we could do? Jende said, smiling. Nenny could make you some puff puff and fried ripe plantains, and I will bring it to you tomorrow. Maybe you can eat some in the car, going to school, and eat the rest, coming back home. Will that make you happy? The boy looked up at him, nodded, and smiled. Chapter 35. They named her Amatimba Monyenge, hoping it was their dead daughter who had returned to bring them happiness. Amatimba, for she has returned, and Monyenge, for happiness, both in their native Bakweri. They would call her Timba for short. She was born on the 10th of December at Harlem Hospital, 2 blocks from their apartment. On the 12th of December, they walked home from the hospital, father cradling newborn daughter in a carrier, mother holding firstborn son by the hand. In their apartment were their friends who had come to celebrate with them. Winston was in Houston for the holidays, to continue wooing Maami back. But 9 friends were packed in the boiling living room to eat and rejoice and welcome Timba to Earth. "Take as much time off as you need," Clark said when Jende called to share the news. "Mighty's going to be on his winter break soon. Cindy is taking some time off work. We'll be fine."
"Thank you so much, sir,"
Jende replied, unsurprised at his employer's generosity.
"Merry Christmas to you and to Mrs. Edwards."
Jende called Cindy, too, to personally tell her the news. She did not return his voice message, but Anna stopped by with a box of size 2 diapers a couple of days later, which he and Nanny assumed was from the Edwardses.
"How can we ever thank Mr. and Mrs. Edwards?"
Nanny asked him after Anna had cooed to Timba and hurriedly left to avoid missing her train home to Peekskill.
"We can't ever," he said. "Let's just remember to always thank God for them and for everything we have." "Truly, we have to," she said.
The next day, a letter from immigration arrived for him. On the basis of being admitted to the United States in August of 2004, with authorization to remain for a period not to exceed 3 months, and staying beyond November 2004 without further authorization, it has been charged that he is subject to removal from the United States, the letter said. He was to appear before an immigration judge to show why he should not be removed from the country. The date was set for the 2nd week of February.
"There's nothing to worry about, my brother,"
Boubacar assured him again when Jende called that evening to discuss the letter.
"I have handled cases like this before. I know what to do."
"What are you going to do?" Jende asked.
"There's not much to do during this first hearing. It's only a master calendar hearing. The judge just wants to verify your name, your address, ask us to admit or deny the charge against you. Different kinds of protocol, things like that. Then, he's going to schedule another date to see you again for who knows when. Like I told you before, my brother, between the backlog in the court and me filing one appeal after another, if we need to, we are going to buy you a whole lot of time in this country."
How much was all this going to cost? Jende wanted to know. If they had to file appeals one after another to buy time, how much would they each be?
"It's going to cost good money, my brother. Immigration is not cheap. You just have to do what you gotta do and pay it. I know my fee is not cheap as some of those nincompoops who go out there and stammer in front of the judge, but you stick with me, and I'll help you through this. That's my promise. We are in this together, my brother. Step by step, together, eh?"
Jende called Winston after getting off the phone with Boubacar. He did not know what to do, he told his cousin, whether to continue believing in Boubacar or change course.
"I don't know, Bo," Winston said. "I think this man is taking you down a bad road."
"But he says he has handled many cases like mine, and they all got approved in the end."
Winston was incredulous. Boubacar, he had decided, was a useless, loud-mouthed buffoon. A former colleague of his, who had left Dustin Connors and Solomon to start an immigration law practice, had recently told him that asylum applications could not be won with preposterous tales like that of a man running to America because he was afraid his father-in-law was going to kill him. Who does he think sits in immigration offices? The former colleague had asked after Winston told him all the pertinent details about Jende's case. Sure, those folks aren't the smartest cookies in the can of federal employees, but they're very intelligent. And they've heard enough false stories of persecution and seen enough beautiful young women proclaim endless love to 90-year-old men for the sake of green cards that they can tell a contrived story from one that resembles the truth. And sure, the former colleague had added, asylum has been granted to applicants running away from nothing. But for heaven's sake, a made-up story should be much better than the laughable crap Boubacar had given Jende. What was also unfathomable about the case, the man went on, was why Jende's asylum application process took so long. He'd heard of immigration cases disappearing into black holes and applicants waiting months and years for interviews and decisions, but Jende's was quite extreme. Which means either he was one unlucky guy, or he had a ridiculously lazy lawyer. Could this former colleague take him on as a client? Jende asked when Winston told him all this. No, was the former colleague's reply. His specialty was investor visas, helping foreign billionaires and multimillionaires obtain entrance and legal status in America through investment, business development, and trade. More lucrative stuff, you know? Jende's case, the former colleague had said, was for a much smarter storefront lawyer than Boubacar.
Why didn't he use a political asylum story? Winston asked Jende,
a question that would have been more useful at their first meeting with Boubacar.
Isn't that what most people seeking asylum use? Langaman's younger brother, the one in Montana, he's claiming he left Pei because Bia was going to put him in Kondengi for challenging him. That paysan never went near a voting booth in Pei, but he's now saying he was a member of SDF and submitting evidence of how his friends were beaten and locked up for months, and how he too could be if he returns to Cameroon. Anyone entering this country can make up any story about what their life was like back in their country. You can say you were a prince or someone who ran an orphanage or a political activist, and the average American will say, oh, wow. Heck, I tell them guys all the time that I was a political activist in Cameroon. When they start asking me things like, so, how's the political situation in Cameroon? Instead of thinking up something like that for you, that useless idiot told you to stick to a story about running away from your father-in-law.
Winston may be right, Nenny said after Jende told her about their conversation. But if a river has carried a load halfway downstream, why not let it take it all the way to the ocean?
Jende agreed. Their fate was in the hands of others. What use would it be to get another opinion and find themselves weighing bleak option against bleak option? They would stay with Boubacar. It was all going to work out.
They encouraged each other to be hopeful, to believe that they would one day realize the dream of becoming Americans.
But that night, they each had nightmares that they told the other nothing of the next morning. Jende dreamed of knocks on the doors, and strange men in uniform taking him away from his fainting wife and crying children. Nenny dreamed of returning to a largely deserted Limbe, a town devoid of the young and ambitious, scantily populated with those too old, too young, and too feeble to flee to distant lands, for the riches that could not be gotten in Limbe. In one dream, she saw herself at the annual canoe race at Down Beach, dancing alone as empty canoes approached the shore. When she woke up, she pulled her sleeping daughter closer to her bosom and kissed her. Timba was going to enter Limbe one day as a proud Cameroonian American. Returning to see the land of her ancestors, she told herself. Not as the child of failed asylees tossed out of the country like food that had turned sour. And Leomi was going to become a real American one day, she whispered in the darkness. He had taken so well to America, hardly missing anyone or anything in Limbe. He was happy to be in New York, excited to walk on overcrowded streets and be bombarded by endless noise. He spoke like an American, and was so knowledgeable in baseball and all the state capitals that no one who came across him would believe he was not an American, but a barely legal immigrant child. A mostly illegal one, in fact, whose future in the country rested on a judge believing his father's incredible story of fleeing persecution. They could never take him back to Limbe. If they took him back, he might no longer be the happy child he is and was before coming to America. He might become angry, disappointed, and hostile, forever resentful toward his parents. On the second night after they received the letter, Nenny spent most of the hours staring into the darkness, unable to stop thinking these things. The next morning, as she ironed her children's clothes, she sang the hymns the church-going people of Limbe sang when life gave them no answers to their questions. She sang a song about having a very big God who was always by her side, and another about Jesus never failing, even though the man of the world would let her down. Singing the songs reminded her of the time she had visited a church in Limbe and left feeling better, happy, and unburdened, because for 2 hours she had been surrounded by joyful people who believed their circumstances were about to change because an omnipotent being was in control. During Timba's naps, she searched the internet for a nearby church to visit. There were many to pick from, most professing acceptance of anyone with any kind of belief, all seemingly just eager to fill up their pews. She decided to go downtown to a church in Greenwich Village called Judson Memorial Church, a brown building facing Washington Square Park, because she enjoyed the street music in the village and loved the fountain at the center of the park where she'd taken Leomi to play the past June. The Sunday before Christmas, while Jende was working, she and the children went to the church. Her mother had warned her not to take the baby too far out of the house before she was 3 months old, but Nenny ignored the advice. She bundled Timba in her carrier and took Leomi by the hand, from the 3 subway to the A. When she got to the West 4th station, she got out and trudged through Greenwich Village. She walked rapidly, breathing out light clouds in the chilly December morning, eager to get to this place of prayer where she could find respite. When she got there, she was disappointed in what she saw. Instead of a house of worship filled with a youthful, diverse crowd of New Yorkers, rocking and jiving and saying amen, the vast, pewless room was full of middle-aged white people, not rocking and not jiving, but rather singing hymns without the slightest attempt to shake their bodies and cast off their cares and sorrows, the way the churchgoers of Limbe did every Sunday morning. Avoiding stares, Nenny settled in a seat at the back, the baby still in the carrier, Leomi quiet by her side. The pastor was a woman with long gray hair and red-framed glasses, who preached about some kind of coming revolution, a message Nenny neither understood nor found applicable to her current situation. After the service, the pastor came to her and introduced herself as Natasha. Other congregants came over, too, to greet her and to admire Timba sleeping in the carrier. One man said he had worked in Cameroon many years before as a Peace Corps volunteer, far up in the northern region of Adamawa. Nenny raised her eyebrows and smiled, surprised and excited to meet someone who had been to her country in a place like that. Though she'd never been to the Adamawa region, she felt as if she'd just reconnected with a long-lost childhood friend.
"I can't believe you have been to my country," she said to the man as she handed her completed visitor information card to an usher. "Some people I meet in America don't even know there is a country called Cameroon."
The man laughed. "Yeah," he said. "Americans were not renowned for their knowledge of African geography. He even knew of Limbe," he added, though he'd never been there. He wished he'd gone there to sit on its black sand beaches.
"Everyone was so happy to welcome us," Nenny told Jende that night.
"Maybe because they don't have black people there, and they want to have a black family," Jende retorted. "Those kind of white people are always trying to prove to their friends how much they like black people."
"I don't care," Nenny said. "I like the place. I'm going to go back."
"What for? You didn't even go to church in Limbe. You're not baptized in any church."
"So what if I'm not baptized? Didn't I used to come with you to Mispa for Christmas and Easter? And didn't I sometimes go to the full gospel near our house?"
"That doesn't mean you were a church kind of person."
"Then I'm going to become a church kind of person now. I think it's good for us to start going to church at a time like this. I was watching on the news the other day about this family that was supposed to be deported and they ran to a church. The church people let them stay in the church. The government could not touch them there.
Jende shook his head and let out a short, derisive laugh.
So you think that's what we are going to do, eh? He asked. What kind of stupid idea is that? I'm not going to hide in any church.
How long did the people stay in the church? I don't know. How am I supposed to know?
You're the one who thinks it's a good idea. Why would I do such a thing? A grown man like me, hiding in a church. For what?
For what? She said. You want to know for what, Jende? For your children. That's what for. So your children can continue living in America.
She stood up from the sofa as she spoke and took a seat at the dinette, irritated by his declaration and not wanting to sit next to him anymore. He seemed taken aback by her sudden anger, infuriated that she dared challenge him on the matter.
You think I don't care about my children? He asked her. You think I won't do anything for us to stay in America?
No,
she said, jumping up from the chair and pointing her index finger directly at him.
I don't think you will fight till the end for us to remain here. I think when the time comes, you will give up because you care too much about your pride. But I'll do whatever I need to do for us to stay in America. I'll go sleep on a church floor, no matter if I have...
She ran to the bedroom and sat on the bed next to her sleeping daughter.
What are you crying for? He said,
having followed her and looking angrily at her from the bedroom doorway.
What are those stupid tears for, Nenny?
She ignored him.
You think I don't want to remain in America, too? You think I came to America so that I can leave? I work as a servant to people, driving them all over, the whole day, sometimes the whole week, answering yes, sir, yes, madam, bowing down even to a little child. For what, Nenny? What pride are you talking about? I lower myself more than many men would ever lower themselves. What do you think I do it for? For you? For me? Because I want us to stay in America. But if America says they don't want us in their country, you think I'm going to keep on begging them for the rest of my life? You think I'm going to sleep in a church? Never. Not for one day. You can go and sleep on the church floor all you want. The day you get tired, you can come and meet me and the children in Limbe. Nonsense.
He slammed the door behind him and left her whimpering in the bedroom. Alone in the darkness, she cried herself to sleep. Timba on her bosom. Leomi in the cot beside the bed. When she woke up early the next morning, Jende was in the living room, sleeping on the sofa. Chapter 36 Christmas was 3 days away, and the darkness that had fallen upon the city appeared to be on hiatus. Outshone by the radiance of lighted trees at Rockefeller and Lincoln Centers, and the mesmerizing displays in shops along Fifth Avenue. Throughout the boroughs, there were steady, if faint, glimmers of hope shining through the windows of apartments where people lived, with the belief that the good times would soon return. Even the despondent willed themselves to the streets, to hear something or see someone or go someplace that would remind them that Christmas time was here, springtime was ahead, and in no time it would be summer in New York City again.
Welcome and a very Merry Christmas to you,
the pastor Natasha wrote in an email to Nenny.
I'm so glad you were able to stop by at Judson, and I'd so love to get a chance to know you more. Please schedule the time to come to the office for a little chat.
Nenny scheduled the meeting for the next day and told Jende nothing of it. In the church office, she met the assistant pastor, a red-headed and bearded young man from New Hampshire named Amos. He told Nenny he used to be a Buddhist monk before deciding that progressive liberal Christianity was more aligned with his beliefs than Buddhism. Nenny was curious about the difference between the two, but thought it wise not to ask. Asking might lay bare her ignorance about religion and spiritual matters, and expose her true motive for coming to the church. In private, the pastor Natasha was a more subdued woman than the fiery preacher who had stood at the pulpit and spoken about the need for a revolution that would shake the country to its core. Her mid-back-length gray hair was straight and side-parted, and Annie couldn't help admiring her courage in growing her gray hair long, and for leaving it gray in a city where there was no shortage of salons eager to rescue middle-aged women from grayness. There were framed pictures of happy families on the bookshelves in her office, families of all kinds, two fathers and a baby, two mothers and a toddler, an old man and an old woman and a dog, a young man and a young woman and a newborn. Natasha told Nenny they were all congregants in the church. She asked Nenny about her family and what brought her to Judson. "I think I want to become a Christian," Nenny responded, to which Natasha replied that she did not need to become a Christian to join the Judson family. Nenny was relieved, though she still wanted to become a baptized Christian. What if the people at the full gospel church near her house in Limbe were right about heaven and hell? She wanted to be on the safe side, so she could get into heaven if it ended up being real. Her family didn't go to church, except for a brief period after her father lost his seaport job. But she believed there was a God, with a son named Jesus, though she had a hard time believing that people speaking in tongues were truly possessed by some spirit. "You can believe whatever you want, and we'll accept you here," Natasha told her. "We take everyone, from anywhere. We don't care if you believe in heaven and hell and pearly gates. We don't even care if you believe that the best way to get to heaven is by subway or Metro North or Long Island Railroad," she added, which made Nenny laugh. Over tea, they spoke about motherhood and marriage. So open was their conversation about the sacrifice of dreams in parenthood and the loss of self in marriage, that Nenny went further than she thought she would and told Natasha about Jende's deportation case. She told her about their argument on Sunday and the shame she would experience if she had to return to Limbe. The sense of failure she might never escape for not having given her children a good life, a life full of opportunities, the kind of life that would be all but impossible for them to have in Cameroon. Natasha listened and nodded, allowing the stricken woman to release months' worth of tears. She offered Nenny a tissue and took Timba when, perhaps sensing her mother's distress, the baby began to cry too. "The American immigration system can be cruel," she told Nenny, rubbing her knee. "But Judson will stand and fight with you. We will stand with you till the end." Nenny Djonga walked out of Judson and into Washington Square Park that afternoon with the lightness of a beautifully crafted kite. There was a man playing a flute on a bench, and a young woman in a black down jacket playing a violin. She smiled as she walked through the park listening to them. She hadn't realized until then how divine classical music was. On the other side of the park, beneath the arch, a group of young people held placards, chanting and protesting the bailout. "Bail us out, not our oppressors. Why are you using our taxes to destroy us? Death to Wall Street. Paulson, the Antichrist." Nenny stood by the empty fountain and watched them, admiring their passion for their country. One of them in particular was a pleasure to watch, a dreadlocked young white man who was prancing and shaking his fist at their absent foes. Someday, Nenny thought, if Judson could help them stay in America, she would be an American citizen, and she would be able to protest like that too. She'd say whatever she wanted to say about powerful people, and have no fear of being thrown into prison the way dissidents were being thrown into prisons in some African countries for speaking out against abominable authoritarian regimes. She wanted to skip around the park, rejuvenated by the hope that had been handed to her by a compassionate woman of the cloth. But she couldn't. Timba was waking up from the cold, and she had to pick up Leomi from his last day of school and cook dinner. When Jende came home from work at close to midnight, she hurriedly dished out his food and sat at the dinette as he took off his jacket, unable to wait any longer to tell him the amazing news of how the people of Judson would help them stay in America. "I went down to the church in the village today," she began, after he'd had a few bites of his dinner.
"What's for?"
"It wasn't for anything.
The pastor sent me an email to welcome me and said I should come for a visit, so I went."
"You didn't think you should tell me before going?"
"I'm sorry. You were angry the last time I went. I didn't want you to get angry again."
He glared at her,
and returned to his potatoes and spinach. She pretended the look wasn't half as nasty as he'd intended it to be. She had to forgive him easily these days, or her marriage would be doomed. She just had to, because he hadn't been the same man since the day the letter for the deportation hearing arrived. The weight of the letter was crushing him, she could see. He was now a man permanently at the edge of his breaking point. No longer did he reach over to stroke her hair while she nursed the baby. He did not care to playfully punch Leomi in the ribs. The husband who seldom uttered words like stupid and idiot was now throwing those words left and right in moments of rage and frustration, directing them at nameless immigration officials, his lawyer, his family in Cameroon, his son, and most of all, his wife. He scolded his mother for asking for money to patch the kitchen wall and barked at Leomi when the child asked if his father could take him to an arcade. He pushed his food away if he thought it didn't have enough salt or pepper, and ignored phone calls from his friends. It was as if the letter of his court appointment had turned him from a happy, living man to an outraged, dying man intent on showing the world his anger at his impending death. "The pastor told me that the church will help us stay in the country," Nanny said. "What are you talking about?" "Our papier situation. I told the pastor about it."
"You did what?"
he said, banging the table. She said nothing. He pushed his food aside and stood up.
"Are you crazy?"
he said, pointing to his temple.
"Are you losing your mind, Nanny? Have you lost your mind? How dare you discuss my papier situation with those people without asking me first? Have you really lost your mind?"
He was fuming and breathing heavily. Beneath him, she sat like a lamb before a teeth-bearing lion.
"What's wrong with you? What is wrong with you these days? You think you have the right to go about discussing something like that with other people without asking me first? Do you know who these people really are? You think because you go to their church for one day, you can tell them my private business? Eh, Nanny? Are you crazy?"
She did not offer an excuse. She knew she had gone too far. Boubacar had warned them to guard their immigration story and share it with no one.
"You tell person say you no get paper," the lawyer had said. "The day you get palaver with them, they go call immigration report you. No one except me, you, the Almighty, and the American government should know how you entered this country and how you're trying to stay in it,"
he had cautioned them repeatedly. He knew of the consequence of their scheme being leaked to the government by a hateful individual. It could spell the end not only for them, but for him too. Nanny had agreed with the lawyer's advice. She believed in the value of keeping certain matters private to protect from negativity and malice. To her, it was not only wise, but easy. Keeping crucial facts concealed was as effortless to her as singing. Back when she was a teenager, she had told no one besides Jende about her pregnancy with their deceased daughter. She had waited to tell even her parents until she was 5 months along, tactfully hiding her growing belly with oversized kabas and handbags. It was equally easy for her to hide their immigration travails in New York. Except for Betty and Fatou, she told no one. When asked by other friends about her family's legal status, she dodged the question by casually saying that their papers would be arriving very soon. Despite her shame, she had told Natasha about their plight because she believed there were Americans who wanted to keep good, hard-working immigrants in America. She'd seen them on the news. Compassionate Americans talking about how the United States should be more welcoming to people who came in peace. She believed these kind-hearted people, like Natasha, would never betray them. And she wanted to tell Jende this, that the people of Judson Memorial Church loved immigrants, that their secret was safe with Natasha. But she also knew it would be futile reasoning with a raging man. So she decided to sit quietly with her head bowed as he unleashed a verbal lashing, as he called her a stupid idiot and a bloody fool. The man who had promised to always take care of her was standing above her vomiting a parade of insults, spewing out venom she never thought he had inside him. For the first time in a long love affair, she was afraid he would beat her. She was almost certain he would beat her. And if he had, she would have known that it was not her Jende who was beating her, but a grotesque being created by the sufferings of an American immigrant life. Chapter 37. On Christmas morning, they ate fried ripe plantains and beans, but exchanged no gifts, since Jende did not want Leomi believing that the giving and receiving of material gifts had anything to do with love. "Anyone can go to the shop and buy anything and give to anyone," he told Leomi when the boy asked for the umpteenth time why he couldn't get even a little toy truck. "The true measure of whether somebody really loves you," he lectured, "is what they do for you with their hands and say to you with their mouth and think of you in their heart." Leomi had protested, but on Christmas morning, as on all the previous Christmas mornings of his life, he got no gifts. In the afternoon, they ate rice and chicken stew, like most of the households in Limbe. Neni made chin-chin and cake, too, using the cake recipe she'd relied on in Limbe in the days when she baked over a blistering fire in an iron pot filled with sand. The night before, while the whole family was on the sofa watching It's a Wonderful Life, Jende had thought about inviting Leah to spend the day with them, since she was probably all alone in her queen's apartment, being that she had no husband or children or living parents. He hated to think that Leah would be alone on a day when everyone should be with someone. But he didn't want to ask too much of Neni, because he was certain that if Leah accepted his invitation, Neni would cook 7 different dishes for the American coming to her house. And he knew he would feel bad that she was doing it while also taking care of Leomi and the baby. So he merely called Leah in the morning to wish her a Merry Christmas. He told her work was going well, then listened as she told him about her plans to go to Rockefeller Center later in the day, speaking excitedly, as if going to stand in the cold and look at a tree was such a wonderful thing. For the rest of the day, he told Leomi stories and rocked Timba to sleep after her feedings. No one came to visit them the way people did in Limbe, going from house to house saying, "Happy, happy, oh!" And yet, it was a happy Christmas for him, far happier than his first Christmas in America. On that day, he had lain on his upper-level bunk bed all morning and afternoon in the basement apartment he shared with the Puerto Ricans in the Bronx. The weather outside too cold for a walk, the people on the streets too unknown to celebrate the specialness of the day with. With Winston gone to Aruba to vacation with a woman he was dating, he had no one to eat and laugh with and reminisce with about the Christmases of his boyhood, which always involved too much eating, too much drinking, and way too much dancing. Lying in the dark room, he had pictured Leomi in the red suit he'd sent for him to wear to celebrate the day. He'd smiled at the thought of his son strolling around town and proudly telling everyone who asked that his clothes were from his papa in America. He imagined Neni taking Leomi to Newtown to wish a happy Christmas to his mother, who must have prepared a meal of chicken stew with yams and a side of ndole, as well as a dish of plantains and yamangoa. He yearned to hear their voices, but there was no way for him to talk to them. The telephone lines from the Western world to much of Cameroon were overcrowded and bursting with the voices of those like him, the lonely and nostalgic, calling home to partake in Christmas merrymaking, if only with their words. Frustrated, he had flung his calling card away and stayed in bed until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, making only one call to his friend Akamo in Phoenix, a call that did nothing to lessen his lonesomeness, because Akamo was having a grand time at a Cameroonian party, thanks to living in a city with a large, close-knit Cameroonian community. After a shower and a dinner of Chinese leftovers, he had sat by the window in the common area, wrapped in his twin comforter and looking outside at the weather so dull, at the people so colorlessly dressed, at the happy day slipping away so quickly and crushing him with longing. 5 days after Christmas, he returned to work, only to find there wasn't much to do. Clark was at a hotel, Anna told him when he called to ask her why the boss wasn't picking up his phone. He was going to do most of his work from there, she added. Cindy was taking time off from work, probably since the day of the tabloid story, Jende guessed, since Anna had called him the day after while he was on his way back from dropping Mighty off at school and told him that he didn't need to come to the Sapphire because Cindy would not be needing a ride to her office. The only person who needed to get around that day was Mighty, to his piano lesson and back. All Jende had to do, Anna said, was take Mighty to his teacher's building on the Upper West Side, hand him over to Stacy, who was meeting him there, and then bring Mighty and Stacy back to the Sapphire an hour later, unless Mighty wanted Stacy to take him to do something else, which was unlikely, since Mighty wanted to do nothing this winter break except sit alone in his bedroom. Jende could go home after that, and the rest of the holidays would be equally light, because Anna said, whispering in a frightened voice, there was no way of knowing how long Clark would stay at the hotel, or how much longer Cindy would keep herself locked in the apartment, now that she wasn't even going out to do things with friends, being that her drinking was getting worse. And poor Mighty now had two parents who, Anna caught herself before she could say too much, and said she had to go. Mighty, my good friend, Jende said after Mighty had settled in the back seat. How was your Christmas?
I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, okay. There's nothing wrong with that. You do not have to tell me, except for one thing. Did you get to Skype with Vince?
Yeah, Mom called him.
How is he? Mighty shrugged and did not respond. He's having fun over there. Did he tell you some good stories about India?
He has dreadlocks.
Dreadlocks? Jende asked, almost laughing at his visualization of Vince with dreadlocks. He liked the look of white people with dreadlocks, but Vince Edwards, son of Clark and Cindy Edwards, with dreadlocks? The look on Cindy's face must have been worth taking a picture of.
Yeah,
Mighty said.
He has, like, some funny-looking dreadlocks.
Really? Did he look good with it? I'm sure he still looks very handsome, right?
I don't know.
Jende decided it was best to leave Mighty alone. He clearly did not want to talk, and attempts to cheer him up seemed to be making him only sadder.
They fought in the kitchen last night,
Mighty said suddenly after minutes of silence. Who? Your mommy and daddy? Mighty nodded. Oh, Mighty. I am so sorry to hear. But remember what I told you about married people fighting? Your mommy and daddy fighting does not mean anything bad. Married people like to fight sometimes. They even shout and scream at each other. But it does not mean anything, okay? Mighty did not respond. Jende heard him sniffle and hoped he wasn't crying again. The child had cried enough.
I heard my mom crying, throwing stuff at the wall. I think it was glasses and plates. They were breaking. My dad was shouting for her to please stop it. But she was...
He pulled a tissue from the pack of tissues Jende was offering him and blew his nose. Your parents are going to be friends again soon, Mighty, Jende said, not only to convince Mighty, but to convince himself, too.
She was saying, I don't ever want to see his face again. She was telling my dad that he had to get rid of him. Get rid of him right now or else...
Get rid of who?
I don't know. But she was screaming it over and over. And my dad was saying, I won't do it. And my mom was screaming that he had to, otherwise she was gonna do something.
I'm so sorry to hear all this, Mighty. But your mommy, she was just angry, right?
She was very angry. She was crying and screaming so loud.
Jende inhaled and exhaled.
I couldn't sleep,
Mighty went on.
I covered my head with my pillow, but...
They did not say the name of this person? Mighty shook his head.
But I think it was Vince.
Vince?
Yeah. My mom was really upset about the dreadlocks. She said he looked like a hooligan.
No, Mighty, Jende said, laughing lightly. There is no way your mommy will ask your daddy to get rid of Vince. Your mommy loves you and Vince a lot.
They're gonna get a divorce.
No, please don't say that, Jende said, holding the steering wheel with one hand and reaching behind to rub Mighty's leg with the other. Do not say these kinds of things and make yourself angry. They will be happy again. It is just how grown people are. They will be friends again.
No, they won't. They're getting divorced.
Please, do not make yourself sad worrying about things that will never happen, Jende said as he struggled to drive with one hand. Everything will be all right, Mighty. Everything will be all right. Everybody will be all right. Please, wipe your eyes. When they got to the building on 89th Street in Columbus, Stacy came out to get Mighty. Jende watched as the boy forced a smile and told Stacy that yes, he was super excited about the piece the teacher had planned for the day. Jende got back in the car after Mighty and Stacy had left and called Winston, who thankfully picked up his phone on the first ring, even though he had barely picked it up since the day he went to Houston to visit Mommy.
Ah, Bo, you and your worries,
Winston said after Jende told him about Cindy wanting to get rid of someone.
She could be talking about 10 different people. Maybe she was talking about...
It has to be me, Jende said, shaking his head in disbelief. There is no other man who works for her. Anna is a woman. Stacy is a woman. Her assistant is a woman. Everyone except me.
Then maybe it wasn't someone who works for her. Women like her, they have all kinds of people who do different kinds of things for them. Doctors who take care of their wrinkles, people who do their hair, people who do their decorations.
You really think she would be screaming in the middle of the night to tell her husband to get rid of the person who does her decorations?
Ah, Bo.
Okay, okay, fine. I just don't want you to worry, that's all.
You cannot hear a story from a little child and start shaking like a leaf, eh?
Don't do this to yourself.
You keep acting like this, and tomorrow a heart attack will hit you. Let me warn you. You don't know anything. You don't even know if the child heard correctly, eh?
Without this job, what will I do? My whole body is shaking. What am I going to do if they...
Hey, what is all this sisa for, eh?
Listen, if you're so afraid, I can call Frank and ask him.
If Cindy wants Clark to fire you, Clark will not hide it from Frank. And I can ask Frank to help you convince Clark.
Yes, please. That would be the best idea. He's the one who helped me get the job, and he likes me. Please do that. Every time I drive him and Mr. Edwards together, he is nice to me.
So there's nothing for you to worry about. I'll call him tomorrow, okay?
I don't know how to thank you, Bo.
Give me your firstborn son to be my servant,
Winston said, forcing Jende to laugh. After he got off the phone, Jende leaned his head against the headrest, closed his eyes, and told himself to think of only good things. His father had always told him that. Even when things are bad, think of only good things. And Jende had done that as often as he could during his darkest days, while in prison after impregnating Nenny. After his daughter had died late one night, and Nenny's father had ordered her buried first thing in the morning, denying him the chance to say goodbye. After Nenny's father had denied his request to marry her for what seemed like the 100th time. After he'd gotten a call from one of Nenny's sisters, 7 months after he arrived in America, telling him that Nenny and Leomi had been involved in a bus accident on their way to visit Nenny's aunt in Muyuka. In those moments, he had done only what was in his power, and thought of the countless number of good things that had happened in his past, and the many good things that were highly certain to happen in his future. He'd done it when he felt powerless, like during those 4 months he'd spent in prison in Buea, waiting for his father to borrow enough money to convince Nenny's father to request his release. Everything about prison had been far more horrendous than he'd imagined. The cold mountain air, which made his skin itch, and had him shivering from evening to morning. The inadequate portions of barely palatable food. The dormitories, packed end to end with snoring men every night. The easily transmittable diseases, like the dysentery he'd caught, which had lasted 2 weeks and kept him writhing all day from stomach cramps and a high fever.